This is The Guardian.
Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Of course, we are concerned about the challenge that China poses.
We're dealing with the tip of the iceberg. The fact is there are many more like him in the UK. There are many more doing the job that he's been doing. There are many, many more involved in exactly this kind of espionage.
Devolution will no longer be agreed by the whim of a minister in Whitehall. It will now be default in our constitution.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. It's Monday, we're back in Westminster, and we're crawling towards the finish line before Parliament breaks for Christmas recess. And this is, of course, Party Week, Kieran, here at Westminster. So after doing our job every day, we end up at a variety of government departments, drinking warm white wine and, if we're lucky, a salt and vinegar crisp or two with various cabinet ministers. Are you planning to go to any of these events?
No.
No?
No. I was planning to go to the children's party, the annual get-together at number 11, which is, to be honest, the highlight of the Whitehall social calendar.
Mr. Marvel, there's a bubble disco for the
Santa
kids.
Santa Claus turning up in the garden. Honestly, it is fantastic. I went last year with the kids, but unfortunately this year, school has organised the Christmas Carol concert for the same evening. So I actually gave my kids the chance. I said, hey, do you want me to sneakily get you out of the Carol concert and we can dash off to Downing Street and see the Chancellor and Santa Claus? No, why would we want to do that?
Children are brilliant levellers, aren't they?
They did not care at all about Downing Street Christmas parties.
My youngest did me a favour by saying that she had no interest in going to Downing Street, which actually then meant I'm free to accept an invite to number 10 Downing Street, where the Prime Minister is going to be doing drinks with lobby journalists. We don't often make it behind the doors, let alone having a drink. So if anyone's out there thinking, oh, journalists getting too cozy with politicians, it's basically a rare event to meet basically the number 10 press team. And then the Prime Minister walks around the room in what we call donuts with one of his advisors. And he's kind of like mobbed by sort of 8 or 10 journalists all at once, all trying to get a sort of a scoop out of him. Although, of course, when everyone else is there, that proves impossible.
Almost impossible.
You end up talking about what you're going to do for Christmas and you know, interesting things like whether you're going to have turkey or goose.
Yeah, that's true. Although every so often a story does come from these drinks events. My favourite one of which was I was in Downing Street in one of these crammed, sweaty rooms upstairs where everybody was packed in, and David Cameron, who was Prime Minister at the time, was doing the rounds. And he came round and I was standing with a group of other journalists, one of whom is our former colleague, Jim Waterson, who at the time was working for BuzzFeed. And along with the Prime Minister as an aide who kind of whispers in his ear about who everybody is and who they work for. And as the Prime Minister approached us, the aide said, this is Jim Waterson, works for BuzzFeed. And Cameron said, what is the BuzzFeed? Which then became a headline. You know, David Cameron says, what is the BuzzFeed?
They'd have loved that. Nothing like a bit of navel gazing in Westminster politics. Well, my invite that I'm most looking forward to is one from the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who has invited a bunch of ambassadors, as he does every year, to a big reception mansion at Lancaster House. I'd love to see that there's a pile of Ferrero Rocher mm-hmm. going around the room being offered to everybody, but sadly, it's not quite that glamorous. But somehow I seem to have wrangled an invite.
So nice.
It's I think one of these I ended up meeting the ambassador for Vietnam. I've met sort of the French ambassador to the UK. It's a really good opportunity to sort of polish off your diplomatic relations and kind of get a bit more of a global perspective on what's going on in British politics and you know, how the rest of the world is seeing us at such, obviously, such an interesting time for global politics, which brings us neatly on to the big story splashing the front pages today and over the weekend, which was that a Chinese businessman who was also photographed with Theresa May and David Cameron and had a close relationship, close friendship with Prince Andrew, has been accused of espionage for the Chinese state. The man, being referred to as H6, has not had his identity revealed, but that, of course, could change later today if the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, allows an urgent question in the Commons and an MP chooses to use their parliamentary privilege to use his name. I mean, frankly, his name is out there right across the internet already. But this isn't the first Westminster spy story of recent years. What do we know about H6?
Well, H6, we know mostly about him from some court documents that were released last week, which is why this story has suddenly come about. He had a background in the Chinese civil service and then went and did a degree at the University of York, set up a bunch of businesses. I actually, as you say, the name is pretty much out there. So I was able to go through and find which businesses this person was involved with. And he has lots, and they're all to do with kind of lobbying or influencing companies, the kind of PR outfits that, to be honest, proliferate across the UK, especially in London, and don't necessarily look themselves suspicious, but obviously that's the kind of activity he was undertaking. We know, by the way, I should say, we know all of this because essentially what happened back in 2021 is he tried to enter the country. He was going back and forth between China and the UK at the time. And one time he tried to enter the country, he got pulled aside as he did so, and they took his mobile devices, electronic devices off him and downloaded all the data from it and found all of these documents suggesting that he had very senior access at high levels, of course, of the royal family, but also it seems now in politics as well. What we don't know is whether this person was actually privileged to any inside information and was passing that back, or was simply mounting some kind of influence campaign on behalf of the Chinese state. Now, the Chinese agency with which he's linked, which is called the United Front Work Department, is exactly what it's about. It's about trying to get elite influencers to represent the Chinese line in foreign countries. If that's all it was, if it was just about pushing Chinese propaganda a bit at senior levels, it's probably not too worrying. But presumably, given that there's a court case over it and there's now court orders trying to keep his identity anonymous, the worry is that it goes much further than that, and that he did have information that he was passing back.
And we shouldn't understate the significance of the UFWD, as it's known. Chairman Mao, obviously once China's former supreme leader, called it one of the three magic weapons of the Chinese Communist Party, the other two being the People's Liberation Army. I think it's the world's biggest army, that, isn't it? And also the propaganda, this is the party's propaganda arm, both internally and domestically. So, you know, it's regarded as a key tool in China's sort of global expansion, and it's increasingly taken on the international challenge of, as you say, befriending, bribing, or otherwise seducing figures of influence. Now, there's a question as to how much Prince Andrew remains a figure of influence that I'm sure we can come on to. But if the immediate response and response in our world here at Westminster, our working world, is obviously MPs not just wanting to name this individual, but China is such a divisive issue across the Commons, and you're already seeing China hawk people like Ian Duncan Smith and Tom Tugendhat, the former security minister, talking about wanting an urgent question, which we might see later this afternoon if the speaker agrees to it, but also putting pressure on ministers to set a timeline to revive what's known as the Foreign Influence Registration Scheme, which had been delayed until next year, and is a sort of a system for anybody that's from any country that's coming to work in the UK for their governments, be it, you know, France on the one hand, Iran on the other, Russia and so on, to go through tiers of vetting. And there's an enhanced tier to this system, which is likely to cover people from the likes of North Korea, Iran, Russia and China. And there's a suggestion from some of the Tories, who obviously were in power until quite recently, that this enhanced tier that this government, which is wanting to engage more with China than the previous one did, notably for economic reasons, but also for geopolitical ones, might be having some problems with keeping China on that enhanced level because it makes that relationship more difficult. And Keir Starmer was at a press conference in Norway this morning, and he admitted that the UK was, of course, concerned about the challenge that China poses, but underlined that the UK government's strategic approach with it is going to engage. That includes, as he said, cooperating, challenging and competing. But that will make quite a few MPs already anxious about this new government's approach to China. It will prompt particular questions about whether the UK government is moving too fast to re-establish some of those links.
Yeah, do you know what's interesting about that is, I mean, you mentioned Ian Duncan Smith. I remember being on a trip with Rishi Sunak when the last China spying scandal broke. And he at the time, I think this was to the G20 in Delhi, was meeting Li Qiang, the Chinese premier, during that. And we were all saying, you know, what about these MPs back in Westminster who are very upset about this? And he kind of slightly dismissively said, oh yes, Ian Duncan Smith again. The point about this story is it's not just Ian Duncan Smith again. And by the way, and I don't mean that in any detrimental way to Ian Duncan Smith, all power to him. He's been waging this campaign for a long time, but it's not just him on his own, I think is the point on this particular
And it's not just
question.
Tory MPs anymore,
it's not
is
just,
it?
Yeah, Blair McDougall, who's a very serious, credible, well-linked-in Labour MP, has also been leading the challenge on this. So there is definitely, there are signs that this concern is cross-party. And if I was in number 10, that's the thing I would be worried about, because you can probably deal with a few Tory malcontents saying, well, you know, we shouldn't be getting so close to China. But if it really starts splitting your own parliamentary party, it becomes much more difficult. And I imagine lots of Labour MPs are very worried, particularly on the human rights question, about Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves putting the economy ahead of any other concern when it comes to dealing with China.
And of course they are, well, we know that Rachel Reeves and Jonathan Reynolds, the business secretary, are travelling out to Beijing in January. We're expecting Keir Starmer to travel out to Beijing at some point later in the year. He, of course, met Xi Jinping for the first time at the Rio G20 summit recently. In doing so, he became the first British Prime Minister to meet the Chinese president since Theresa May did in 2018. So there's been a fair few British prime ministers since then. And it very much gets to the heart, the fact that they're meeting and they're going on these trips get to the heart of the UK government's new strategic approach to China. And the fact that, like it or not, it is based on the economy. And there are those within government say, look, it's about economic realism. Yes, we're concerned about some of the competition elements, and we're particularly concerned about some of the security elements. And this story today about the alleged Chinese spy underlines that. But also they're aware that China is a massive trading partner, one of the biggest economies in the world, and that if Britain domestically wants to boost growth, it needs inward investment, and that China might look like an obvious place to go and court some of that.
Can I also say something about the foreign influence registration scheme? I mean, first of all, it's incredible to me that we don't have something like this already. In America, they have something called FARA, which essentially is the same thing. And FARA is taken incredibly seriously in American political circles. And the point is that if you are a PR agency, as I was saying, in the UK, particularly in London, we have a lot of these kind of agencies operating, and you are doing work on behalf of a foreign government, that's all fine as long as you tell us. There are people who have gone to jail for not filling in their FARA returns properly, for not declaring that they're working on behalf of foreign governments. In fact, this was at the heart of the Mueller report into, you know, Trump and his relations with Russia, but also other countries. And there were people in Trump's orbit who went to jail because they didn't declare that they had taken on work on behalf of foreign governments. We don't have anything like this in this country. And yet we also have probably per capita one of the biggest PR industries in the entire world. Westminster is full of agencies with slightly abstract names that you can never quite keep hold of who is representing whom. And they never publish their client lists. And you don't know who they're working for. And there is just no public record of who is working for whom and whose interests they're serving. So we've just been, both of us, watching the Prime Minister giving a press conference over in Norway, where he's meeting his Norwegian counterpart. And he was asked specifically about this registration scheme. And he said, oh, it'll be in place shortly. Well, it's already too late. Mm. Yeah. And to have no indication of when this is going to actually come out. I think if I was in my old job in America, in Washington, I'd just be looking over at British politics at this point, thinking this is really amateurish.
Yeah, and particularly when a new government's coming in, because of course, as we've mentioned, it's not the first example of China allegedly spying on people at the heart of our political system. You mentioned a case that involved two UK men who have been charged with spying for China. They've pled not guilty. This is Chris Cash and Chris Berry, and the trial date's due for October 2025, but they've been accused of breaching the Official Secrets Act on behalf of China and providing prejudicial information to Beijing. But as we say, it's a new government here, a relatively new government here. And, you know, one of the sort of immediate reactions to this story over the weekend is sort of surprise by how easy it can be seen to pay for influence. Now, we mentioned that, you know, you might ask the question about how influential Prince Andrew still is. But it's not just about whether he knew state secrets. It's also about the sort of the respectability, if you mm-hmm. like, that comes from a senior member of the royal family, albeit one who has now taken a back seat in royal duties because of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. It's not the first time he's been caught up in a potential scandal, and that court document that's found on H6's phone will have caused some alarm in Buckingham Palace. You know, we know that he was invited to the Duke's birthday party in March 22. We know he was authorised to act on his behalf in an international finance initiative with potential partners, investors
in
China.
That was really interesting, wasn't it?
And then there was one quote, which I'll quickly read out from a document that was also found on the businessman's phone that had main talking points for a call with the Duke, which he said he was in, I quote, a desperate situation and will grab on to anything. Now, the royal family has, the officials in Buckingham Palace have decided that they don't have the authority to demand access to the prince's own financials, you know, where he gets his money from. There are big questions over that. There's been reports that he might decide to move to the Gulf, where he would still have the status conferred on him of being a senior royal, but perhaps with less of the scrutiny that inevitably comes with remaining here in Britain. But, you know, I think, I'm not sure there are many examples of senior individuals that were quite so naive as to develop relationships with very well-connected and senior Chinese businessmen as Prince Andrew. But public will understandably be asking the question, well, if you can do it to Prince Andrew, what about senior politicians who are new to this game, enjoying the trappings of power potentially? Are they being buttered up in the hope of getting sensitive, whether it's commercial or security information as well?
Yeah, well, you know, people are very susceptible to that when they're junior, and also as Prince Andrew is when they're more senior but don't have money. And there have been questions about how exactly Prince Andrew is able to maintain his royal property, because he's essentially been cut off financially by the royal family, yet still is living in the Royal Lodge at Windsor, which, you know, costs millions of pounds each year to keep. Just as a footnote, I noted that Buckingham Palace wasn't officially commenting over the weekend on Prince Andrew, because they said he's no longer a serving royal. That's a fairly cowardly cop-out, I think, from a press officer
putting it down to Prince Andrew's bad judgment, volume, whatever, you know, 25.
Yeah, nothing to do with us, though, because he's not really a royal anymore. Okay, thanks for that.
So coming back to this morning, we've got Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, revealing details of her revolution in local government. She's been announcing plans to scrap smaller district and county councils and to introduce more unitary authorities and metro mayors. What do we know about this white paper so far, Kieran?
Yeah, this is something Labour have been talking about doing for a while, and possibly the biggest change will be to try and get councils to move away from two-tier systems. So you do have this, particularly in rural areas, where you'll have district or whatever level councils, and then a larger council on top of that. The Labour government wants local authorities to move to a unitary council model, which probably will mean, frankly, some councillors losing their jobs and just a slightly more streamlined form of government. But at the heart of this is this idea that if you operate more in a regional way, they talk about in the same way about planning as well, then you have more clout. And I think that the feeling is the metro mayors have been incredibly successful.
Yeah, first set up obviously in London by Tony Blair, and then built on by George Osborne when he was Chancellor.
Massively
with West
so.
Midlands and Manchester in particular.
Yeah, I mean, when George Osborne used to talk about devolution, I think, yeah, there was some scepticism, but this is the one piece of devolution that really was very, very successful. And you now have very powerful mayors, you know, people like Andy Burnham, obviously Sadiq Khan in London, Steve Rotherham. You know, these are people with national profiles who are able to lobby on behalf of their areas. But the problem is they're still very metro. So you don't have mayors in other many other regions of the country outside the big cities. And that has always been the piece of that devolution jigsaw, I think, that's missing. So that's going to be one of the next big pushes, to try and get more mayors and to get those mayors more powers, because you know, that's the one thing that's really been lacking, I think.
But the one thing they will not have, of course, alongside that more power, is fiscal devolution. And that has been a huge problem for many local authorities. We've seen the amount of councils which have been pushed to the brink of bankruptcy. They've had their budgets cut dramatically over the last 15 years. And the average council spends two-thirds of its budget on adult and children's social care, meaning that there's less money available for any non-statutory services that they're responsible for delivering. So I think there's a bigger question here. Yes, you can make the case for infrastructure and planning, putting power closer to people, although, as you say, in some cases, it will involve actually moving up a power tier. So people at local level might feel that actually their devolved government, local government, gets that a little bit more distant. But there's not been an answer when it comes to council funding. Now, this government has talked about having a different funding settlement and slightly tilting the balance back towards more deprived areas. So I think we can expect to see that. But there's been not a jot of serious discussion about reforming council tax. I mean, it's so politically toxic, despite the fact that properties in places like London and the South East have increased sevenfold in the last 30 years plus, and compared to like councils in the North East, which have increased four times. Now, I was reading a piece by our colleague Heather Stewart, our new economics editor, over the weekend, and she was making this point about property, council property, is not being revalued, slight tangent here, for council tax purposes since 1991, which was, of course, when Mikhail Gorbachev was president of the USSR and Chesney Hawkes was number one with you, the one and only. So I think it just gives you an idea of how long it has been since anybody has seriously looked at how councils get their money. Rachel Reeves has made it clear that there will not be fiscal devolution in terms of councils or new strategic authorities led by mayors or otherwise being able to raise more taxes locally. Tax is obviously a very difficult word in politics, but there will be pressure for, if not their own powers, then certainly more funding to deliver on some of the priorities which they're facing.
And look, Labour have said we want to have multi-year settlements so that councils can start planning properly and have more autonomy about how to spend the money that we give them, which is fine. I mean, it's a first step. But just as a sense of how undevolved we are in terms of how much power councils have to spend local money, I wrote a story that was published over the weekend based on some freedom of information requests by the local government expert Jack Shaw that showed that of all the levelling up money that was allocated by the last government, local authorities only managed to spend 25% of it, simply because, you know, their priorities weren't necessarily the same as national priorities. Anytime there was a problem, whether it was inflating costs or whatever, they'd have to go back to Whitehall to get permission to make any small changes to these schemes. I mean, it's been the bane of councils' lives that they are so hamstrung when it comes to spending their what should really be their own money. So I think, you know, any small steps in that direction will be probably welcomed by local authority leaders.
We should just quickly say, though, that this all follows on from the announcement last week that the National Planning Policy Framework was being updated and would give English councils mandatory targets to build 370,000 homes a year. That puts a huge pressure, obviously, on some local authorities which haven't, frankly, been building enough. The government wants to reach or at least get very close to their 1.5 million new homes target. They believe it'll help boost growth, as well as, obviously, sort of the, you know, the social justice aspect of helping more people get on the housing ladder. But it won't just be, it's not just Conservative councils that are pushing back against this, or indeed Lib Dem ones. There's been stories around this morning about Labour-controlled local authorities who are concerned about hitting their targets. 42 those Labour-run authorities across the country are going to see their targets double from their existing rates. And if they don't deliver on them, they face direct control being taken by Whitehall to grant development permissions. These are places right across the country, like Broxtowe, the East Midlands, Tamworth, South Tyneside, West Lancashire. So it's not just a sort of a challenge that the government's going to have with, you know, political opposition, but also with its own side.
Do you have the quotes there from the leader of Broxtowe Council? Because these really give an indication of what opinion is in some of the more rural and semi-rural councils.
Yeah, so this is a guy called Milan Radulovic, the Labour leader of Broxtowe Council in the East Midlands, who says that theirs is the only authority that actually met its target last year, and that was the highest number it had ever achieved. He said that he wasn't actually concerned about direct control from Angela Rayner. He says, this is the sort of nonsense that government ministers spout in a glib answer to Parliament. They come out with these ridiculous figures without ever giving it any thought on how it's going to be achieved. All I would say to them is, who's going to build them? Perhaps if ministers had a six-month basic building course or a planning course, then they might understand what they're actually talking about for once.
Take that, Angela Rayner.
Wow.
And for more on the state of local government funding, you can listen back to John Harris's episode of Politics Weekly UK in October, where he went to Birmingham, the largest local authority in Europe, to hear the very real impact the council's effective bankruptcy was having on its residents.
Just while we're on the economy, I wanted to flag something very quickly, which I think is going to be a big issue come the new year. There are a host of economic data out this morning, including the manufacturer's confidence index, which fell from 6.8 to 5.8. That's a score out of 10, which is the heaviest fall since the spring of 2020, which of course is when the pandemic was hitting. That comes after the terrible GDP figures we've had over the last couple of quarters. There is now talk that I'm picking up from people close to the Treasury that they're getting slightly worried that their main fiscal rule might actually be broken next time that we get an OBR update in the spring. So, of course, the main fiscal rule that Rachel Reeves has is that day-to-day spending should be paid for entirely by taxes and not by borrowing. Well, if growth isn't high enough, we're going to break that fiscal rule. And Rachel Reeves will have to say how she's going to plug the gap. Now, she doesn't want to do a fiscal statement come the spring, but she might be forced to make some changes to her own fiscal plans if the economy continues to do as badly as it is doing. So anyway, that's just one very quickly to watch. And I think that's something we'll be talking about a lot in the new year. But before we go, this year for the Guardian and Observer's annual charity appeal, we're asking for your support to help individuals whose lives have been turned upside down as a result of conflict. We're partnering with War Child and MSF to support individuals impacted by the horrific effects of war, from emergency aid to psychological support. Plus, we've also teamed up with Parallel Histories, who help schools teach children about contested conflicts. If you can, please donate now at theguardian.com/donate24.
Now, that's all from us on Politics Weekly Westminster for this year. But we'll be back in the new year. And you haven't got rid of us just yet, because this Thursday we'll be joining John Harris for our Politics Weekly UK end of year special, probably fuelled by a mince pie or two, where we'll be taking some of your questions, whether it's about 2024 and what's been, or what might come around the corner in 2025. Get in touch with me or Kieran or John on any of our social media pages.
I've got a couple of surprises in store for you for that episode.
Better tune in. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.